Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to another Curzon Film Podcast. This week, Tim Burton directs a mammoth Dumbo update for Disney, but is he up to the task? Plus, the art newspaper's Martin Bailey talks to us about Van Gogh portrait at Eternity's Gate, and we decide just how much we're loving this Vincent. I'm Jake Cunningham, and wielding canvases of conversation and etchings of insights, I'm joined by Ella Kemp.
Hello.
Sam Howlett.
Hello.
And Stephen Ryder.
Hello.
How are you all doing?
Very
good.
Well.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's another glorious week at the cinema, isn't it?
It always is.
It always is. That is the right answer. So we will start, I think, with At Eternity's Gate. So this has earned an Oscar nomination for Willem Dafoe playing Vincent van Gogh, who leads an ensemble full of starry might, including Oscar Isaac as Paul Gauguin and Rupert Friend as Theo van Gogh. Here we find Dafoe's Vincent as a complex, troubled soul. He's committed to an asylum at one point. He's seeking a new visual language whilst also struggling to make sense of himself and his connection to those around him. And we're going to talk to the art newspaper's Martin Bailey all about the artist and get a bit more background about him and the period of his life that this film covers. And this is a new film directed by Julian Schnabel. Sam, for listeners who might not know the name, they might know his films.
Yeah, so Julian Schnabel, he was actually an artist himself in the 80s and 90s in the sort of New York scene. He's probably, I think, for everyone in this room, his most famous work is the By the Way album cover.
Oh, yeah, I remember it very well.
That's him. And his first film was the Jean-Michel Basquiat film with Jeffrey Wright, Basquiat. And he hung out with him, and he was in that kind of scene when he was younger. And he moved into feature filmmaking. I think his most famous film, because he's only made about five or six, but his most famous film is Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which if you haven't seen is a really beautiful film. I'm a really big fan of that film, actually. And so obviously, a filmmaker and an artist, it makes perfect sense that he would move in to make this film about the world's most famous artist.
Mm. And it's interesting that this feels like a nice pairing to where he started his career. The Basquiat film, when you look at it, it's actually his death is fairly recent to the creation of that film, and he's working with someone who's very much a contemporary artist who is still part of the zeitgeist at the time of that film's creation. And that's how he started his career, and now 25 years later we're seeing him again tackle someone whose life and death is hugely significant within the art world, but very much an older figure.
Yeah, absolutely, and it ties in nicely with obviously the Van Gogh exhibition at the Tate that's happening at the moment as well. So there's all these nice things tying together about the release of this film.
And it's interesting that you call him an older figure when, you know, in the film he mentioned that maybe he's a painter that's kind of like out of time, that he was painting at a time when his paintings weren't going to be recognised. So in a way, like, I think a lot of people these days do look at Van Gogh as a modern painter, just who painted a long time ago.
Mm, yeah. All right. So to get a bit more of a background on the great man, here is our very own Curzon blog editor, Ryan Hewitt, and the art newspaper's Martin Bailey.
So before we begin, can you just clarify and make sure that I'm saying Van Gogh's name correctly?
I'm afraid not, but it's very difficult to say correctly because the English find it almost impossible to pronounce the Dutch, which is something like Van Gogh, but even I can't do it properly. But it is complicated because in America he's called Van Gogh, and in France they all call him Van Gogh. So Van Gogh. It's actually quite difficult. We could say Vincent, and he always wanted to be called Vincent. He said because foreigners couldn't pronounce his name, they murdered his name, and that's why he actually signs his paintings Vincent. It's slightly unusual to use your Christian name, but he did.
Oh, that is unusual, yeah. So should we agree to refer to him as Vincent from
Let's
now on?
Let's do that.
Excellent. So I'm joined by Martin Bailey, correspondent for the art newspaper, specialist on all things Van Gogh, Vincent, I should say, and author of a number of books about the artist, including most recently Starry Night, I have to say, Van Gogh at the Asylum. The first thing I want to ask you, could you tell us a little bit about your book? Because I understand it covers a period that we actually see in Julian Schnabel's film At Eternity's Gate. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, the book Starry Night is on the year that he spent at the asylum after he cut his ear and mutilated his ear. And so much has been written on Van Gogh, but there's been very little detailed study of exactly what happened at the asylum and what life was like. And I actually found an unpublished and unknown register of the patients at the asylum, and there were only 18 men. And that enabled me to provide a context of what it must have been like to be at the asylum. And I think it must have been a terrible place. I mean, the other patients were in very dire conditions. One of them couldn't speak, and he was sometimes violent and broke furniture. Well, that's not surprising if you can't communicate. So Van Gogh was living in a very difficult situation and circumstances, and part of that is portrayed in the film.
That's right. He's during those sequences, he speaks a lot about sort of a divine calling that he seemed to feel, that it was his purpose on earth to paint. Is that something that felt authentic to you, that idea of him as having this sort of almost illusion to grandeur, but perhaps justifiably?
Well, I wouldn't quite put it like that. It certainly wasn't divine in a religious sense. He felt he had an enormous commitment to painting. He felt he was doing the right thing, and he felt it was the one thing in life he needed to do. And I don't think he would have survived his year at the asylum if he hadn't had painting to distract him. It was his way of escaping from the terrible realities and indignities of daily life. And it gave him a purpose and a reason to live. And of course, we must be thankful for what he produced during that year, because he produced a huge number of paintings, including some of his greatest works, pictures of irises, the Starry Night canvas, and the wonderful landscapes of Provence, which is so well portrayed in the film.
And the film itself is called At Eternity's Gate, and that's the name of one of his paintings. Is it Sorrowing Old Man?
Yes, there's a painting that he did at the asylum, which is called At Eternity's Gate. And it was when he was not in good health and he was unable to go outside the asylum to explore the landscape of Provence. So he asked his brother to send some of his earlier works and some prints. And one of the prints which his brother sent him from Paris was one he'd done many years earlier of an old man with his head in his hands. And Van Gogh did a large version of that in oil paints. And I think it's very interesting, but there were two men who were aged 77, which was quite old in those days, who were at the asylum. And I suspect that the picture may have been partly based by seeing them in the common room with looking depressed with their head in their hands. It's a very apt title for the film.
So the film depicts a period of Vincent's life when he had a very close working relationship with Paul Gauguin. And is that something that is overstated in the film, or was it as significant as it seems to be in the film?
It was very important. I mean, Van Gogh, when he arrived in Arles, he moved into a little house, which he called the Yellow House, and he wanted to share it with one of his progressive artist friends from Paris. This was partly to save money and partly because he thought it'd be stimulating and interesting to work with someone else. And then Gauguin came and he spent 2 months with Vincent in Arles. To begin with, it was very productive and they put their easels up side by side. But they increasingly argued with each other. They would go to the bars in the evening and end up discussing art and got very heated. And the relationship soured. And it was at the end of this period was ended when Van Gogh had some sort of mental attack, mutilated his ear, and Van Gogh went to the hospital and Gauguin returned to Paris. But artistically, Gauguin played an important role in Van Gogh's development of his art, and it was a stimulating and exciting collaboration.
Is there a particular work where you can really see that change, that influence, and what he was doing before and after his time with Gauguin, or is it more a more subtle development?
It's mainly more subtle, but Gauguin felt it was very important to work from the imagination. Van Gogh was much more in favour of working in front of what he was painting, so he needed to go out into the landscape to see the olive trees and then paint the olive trees. Gauguin's approach was rather different, and he would do something which was much more imaginative and symbolic, if you like. Now, both approaches have their pros and cons, but Van Gogh tried adopting Gauguin's stress on the imagination, but he found that difficult. And in the end, he really went back to relying on what he could see. So when he was at the asylum, for example, he would look out of his bedroom window, which had bars on to prevent accidents, and he would paint the wheat field below in different seasons, in different weathers. And that was his inspiration.
So the next thing I want to ask you is about this film is slightly controversial in some respects, particularly in the art world, for the way it depicts Van Gogh's death. In the film, we see a sequence where he's outside and he's painting a picture and two young men walk over, one described as looking like Buffalo Bill, and they're carrying a gun. There's a scuffle. Vincent is shot. The painting is stolen. It's buried. The gun is thrown into a river. And then it's suggested that he was murdered, but I understand that the official line on what happened to Vincent is that he committed suicide.
Well, that is the accepted wisdom, that it's suicide. The theory that Van Gogh was either murdered or was killed as manslaughter was first really put forward in a biography which was published by two American authors in 2011. That was by Nathan Smith. I never believed that theory. I am convinced that it was suicide. And the main reason I would say for the suicide theory is that that's what all his friends and family thought. His friend Emil Bernard wrote a letter to say that he'd committed suicide in full lucidity. And Theo, his brother, believed that he'd committed suicide. The church in Auvers, where he died, thought it was suicide. And because of that, they were unwilling to allow a hearse to be used, the church hearse. Suicide at that time in a Catholic country was very much frowned upon, and it's difficult to believe that everyone, including Van Gogh, would have claimed it was suicide when it wasn't. That's the simple answer. I mean, one can go into all sorts of complicated details, but in simple terms, that's why I think it was suicide.
And do you know where the idea that it was ever murder came from? Or was there, presumably there's something that suggests that, even if it is, as you say, discredited?
Yes, there was someone in the 1950s who'd been a young boy in Auvers who wrote an article which was rather unclear about the circumstances of Van Gogh's death and suggested that he might have been involved, but he didn't explicitly say that he had killed Van Gogh. And it was this article which led the two American biographers to put forward the theory. Now, it's interesting that it's put forward in the film, but of course, it's an artistic film, and it's Schnabel's interpretation of what might have happened. But I think it's important that viewers don't look at the film as a documentary, but they look upon it as an artist's interpretation of what might have happened.
Indeed, and I think Julian has said himself that he sees the work as a work of fiction, more an expression of what he thinks Van Gogh and his work was, rather than, like, as you say, a biopic to be taken as true.
That's correct, although I doubt that the posters say that it's a work of fiction.
There's something interesting about this idea of new works being uncovered. I think, if I'm right in saying, as recently as last month in San Francisco, a new work of Vincent's has been authenticated. Is it still Life with Fruit and Chestnuts?
Yes, that's right. And I published that story in the art newspaper where I do a blog. A lot of people think that they've got a genuine Van Gogh paintings and drawings. And I probably hear from maybe two people every week. They're very rarely true that they are authentic. In the case of the San Francisco painting, it had an uncertain status for many years in the museum, and it was then finally examined at the Van Gogh Museum, where they've got the proper facilities and expertise, and they can sort of look under the paint, and they have deemed that it is authentic. Now, coming back to the film, Schnabel in the film puts forward this idea that there was this group of 64 unknown sketches which were in a ledger. Now, I think I am convinced those drawings are not authentic, and they have been examined by the Van Gogh Museum, who have the specialists who've come to the same conclusion. At the end of the film, there's some text which comes on the screen in a form which doesn't appear earlier in the film, and it says that Madame Ginoux, who was the woman who ran the Café de la Gare, where Van Gogh lodged for a short time, it says, Madame Ginoux never knew Vincent had returned the account ledger to her, having filled it with 65 drawings. The ledger was found 126 years later in 2016. Now, that's not actually true, because I saw the drawings in 2010, 6 years earlier, and at that time I had very serious doubts about their authenticity, and I never pursued the matter. So that's actually factually incorrect. But I think it's a bit misleading of Schnabel to put this up at the end as facts, and I think they will be interpreted as facts because of the way the letters appear on the screen. I think he's gone slightly too far at the end.
But with regards to Julian's interpretation of things, there have been a number of films about Vincent throughout the years. Are there any in particular that stand out as being very true to your understanding of who he was, and how do you think that at Eternity's Gate, for all of the imaginary leaps that it may take here and there, is it a good view, a good depiction of the man?
Well, films have certainly had a huge impact on the way the public perceives Van Gogh. I mean, the first major film was Lust for Life, and everyone remembers the title of that, and that was produced in the 1950s, and it was based on a novel which was written in the 1930s. And since Lust for Life, there have been a stream of films on Van Gogh. Most of them make extensive use of his letters, and there are hundreds and hundreds of letters. So they at least have some sort of truth in the words that are spoken in the films. Schnabel has opted to do something different, and I quite understand why. Why do yet another film on Van Gogh? So he's done something much more imaginative, and he's an artist, a painter himself, as well as a filmmaker. So it's his interpretation. It's probably much less true than most of the other films, or many of the other films. But Schnabel was interested not really in simply recounting the story of Van Gogh. He's much more interested in the process of art and what is involved. And I think that's what he's trying to bring over. So I think it's important that viewers should look at the film in that light.
The last thing I want to ask you, Martin, is I understand that you are also involved in the new exhibition at Tate Britain. Is there If someone were to see the film and then go to the exhibition, or the other way around, is there a nice companion piece in those two things? Is there a particular work on display that they should gravitate towards?
They're actually very different, but equally interesting. Schnabel's film is about Van Gogh's years in France, in Paris and Provence and Auvers, where he committed suicide. So the last few years of his life. The exhibition at Tate Britain is about Van Gogh's earlier period when he was working in London, in Covent Garden actually, as an art dealer, which may come as a surprise. And he was here for several years. He came when he was 20, which is a very impressionable age for anyone. And he really became very interested in English art, English literature and English culture, and he learnt to speak English very well. So the exhibition is about his years in England, and the second half of the show is about the influence of Van Gogh on later British artists. So there's two parts to the show. So they're actually entirely different parts of Vincent's life. Go to Tate Britain and see the very early years before he took up his paintbrush, and go and see the Schnabel film to see what happened when he picked up the brush.
Okay, so thank you so much, Martin, for lending us your thoughts there. Let's dive into this film and, in a broader sense, approach it as a biopic in recent weeks, because it has been the Oscar season. It's been something that we've talked about a lot, and we've talked about the different ways that films want to approach it, how different directors will leave their certain brushstrokes on it, if you will. Ella, how does Julian Schnabel approach this?
I think he approaches this biopic extremely differently. I must admit I was quite sceptical going into this because, as you say, we have seen so many biopics recently. You know, there's been On the Basis of Sex, Vice, The Front Runner, all kinds of different things in different spheres. And I think a lot of recent biopics, for me, suffer because the film relies on how exciting the person is rather than building some kind of work of art around it and really throwing you into the world of this person and this kind of, yeah, completely new universe. Whereas At Eternity's Gate is it's kind of insane how different it is as a film. And even just from the moment that everything is so shaky, physically, visually, sonically, everything is completely unstable from start to finish, in a way that can be deemed, you know, immersive and exciting, but also a bit seasick. So I think that can have a bit of a trying impact on a moviegoer who just, you know, wants to learn a bit more about Van Gogh in the same way that other biopics are kind of...
This is not a BBC4 film about Van Gogh.
Right, yeah, it's like really innovative and daring and bold, you know, kind of like the artist, you could say.
I think that's what's so exciting about this is you do look at a new film about Van Gogh coming out and you say to yourself, like, why?
Mm.
Yeah. Why are you doing this again?
Put that on the poster.
Why 2019? But the fact is, he takes this film, he takes this painter, and he takes this icon, and he molds something, as you said, I think that's a really important point, is he molds something around him rather than just focusing purely on, you know, who was this man and what did he do? He molds a world around him, and that's what's so exciting, I think, about At Eternity's Gate.
Okay. Well, something that I struggle with these artistic portrait films is when a filmmaker may try and inhabit the artwork style of the artist within the film, and almost rather than try and just give them the kind of adoration that maybe they and respect that they deserve, it feels like they're trying to match them in some way. Do you think Schnabel struggles with that? I don't think the film is immediately accessible, and I certainly struggled with it at points because of that reason.
I think that Schnabel approaches Van Gogh as a improviser. He approaches him as somebody who, I mean, he puts at the end of the film that he, during the portion, a large portion of this film was spent in 80 days and he did 75 paintings during that time. You know, he portrays him as someone who improvised his paintings. He didn't think very long. It was all one long stroke of the brush. And I think that it's that is the mimicry that we're seeing here, is Schnabel seems to have taken a very improvisational approach with this film. The camera seems to have just sat in a room with Willem Dafoe as he inhabits this character and followed him around, and we've seen it cut up into these kind of bite-sized pieces. I think in the editing room there's been a lot of improvisation regarding, I think, sonically, like you said. There's a lot of repetition of sound and repetition of images. There's the first person kind of point of view shots. There's the focus going in and out, and all that kind of adds up to this very kind of messy palette in exactly the same way that you'd see Van Gogh's paintings. However, it's not like the animation that came out last year, which, you know, it was kind of very nice to look at, but in my opinion, not particularly enthralling in the slightest. It felt like a video game.
That's more an achievement.
Yeah, and it opens, Loving Vincent opens with the title saying, the film you're about to see is made up of this many original paintings. And it also says it at the end as well. So I felt like, what do you not want me to look at anything else? It just kind of, you know, mute the film and
I think Schnabel is a lot more interested. I mean, there's a quote from him that says that this is not the official history. It's my version, one that I hope could make you closer to him. And I think he's been very open about, you know, this film not being a historical kind of biopic. It's a experiential one. It's a kind of expressive biopic rather than impressionistic one, which is a conversation, again, that they have within the film. So
yeah, whether this rubs you the right way or wrong, to me, this kind of feels like if later stage Terrence Malick decided 100%. To make a Vincent Van Gogh.
Very Malicky.
So Malicky.
There's suddenly like fields of wheat as well.
No, you're absolutely right.
But I think it's that song to song Night of Cups Malick. Mm. This is not a Badlands Malick feeling that I think is here. And I think let's delve into the performance, because it obviously got Willem Dafoe's Oscar nomination. And I think this film wants to make you aware of the fact it is a performance. And when you look at Schnabel's previous films, he even directed a concert film as well. Mm. I think he's very focused in on the idea of performance.
Well, Willem's not defoning it in.
Hey.
Oh, no.
The whole awards season. But throughout the whole awards season, Willem Dafoe wasn't getting talked about. He was talked about as kind of a dark horse, or even like a few ranks below a dark horse. And he wasn't really getting those big nominations until the Oscars, which is really, I think it's really interesting when someone can be ignored all awards season and suddenly be given one of the biggest accolades, you know, just to be nominated, obviously, is incredible. So this performance has captured a certain part of an audience. I think it's the actors that noticed that. Mm. So this film, as you'll have seen in the trailer and all the posters, you know, it's his face is the key thing about this film. And you've got all these incredible shots of the background, but mostly I think what you come up thinking about is Willem Dafoe's face.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And the camera, it's not just a close-up, it's an extreme close-up. It's like an alarming close-up.
Yeah, and Street, First Man, The Favourite, we're seeing a lot of this at the moment.
Yeah, and they're like properly like invasive close-ups as well.
It feels like an interrogation.
Yeah, it's almost uncomfortable how close the camera is to his face in this film. And I think, you know, these are all films, you said First Man, A Star Is Born, these are all films that are, you know, they're telling these big, fantastic stories, but what they really care about is these characters. And I think on the most basic way to do that is just to show the characters, just kind of cutting out the rest of the fat, in a sense. And more so with First Man than any of those others, you know, Eternity's Gate and First Man are films about very famous, almost mythical, legendary figures in our culture that we look back on. And we don't really think of them as people, we think about what they achieved. And both Schnabel and Chazelle, I think, wanted to get rid of what they achieved in a sense, but have it in the background, but really want you to look at these people as people and how that affected them. And, you know, the most sort of primal way to do that is just looking at their face, looking at how their eyes twitch.
The best example of that is his conversation with Mads Mikkelsen, when it really feels as though he convinces you that he's got delusions of grandeur. When in reality, he's the most famous painter of all time. But he convinces you, you're like, oh, Vincent, it's never going to work for you, mate. And you're like, no, you know, he's that kind of inside himself. Mm. You can't see him succeeding, at least in the time that he's alive.
Yeah.
I think that's an incredible achievement for you know, Dafoe to get.
But then it's the same with Neil Armstrong in First Man, in that both Vincent Van Gogh and Neil Armstrong seem like two men who don't know how to talk about their feelings. Mm. And so they're, instead, as an audience member, you see the world like you have to see it through their eyes because they can't like spell out the words that someone else who would be, I don't know, have the framing device of a therapist be like, oh, this is everything that's going through my mind, everything that's wrong with me. So instead, you have to have this visual way in that's really arresting. And I think it only works if you've got actors who are as good as Ryan Gosling, as Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, they're not afraid to be vulnerable on screen and show every kind of crevice of their face and have all the attention be on them, and like not you know, the pressure's all on them, not so much the other actors or the scenery or any other person on set. It's just that person's face for a very long time. And the shots on his face here seem to last ages.
I think the way that it approaches people, faces, and intimacy is quite fearless. Even from both a directorial point of view and from a performance point of view, I'm thinking of the moment where Theo van Gogh lies in bed with his brother at the asylum, which is a really poignant emotional moment. And you can see the actors kind of putting everything on the table in that moment. And I think that's the environment that Schnabel has created, and that's the palette that he's given to the his collaborators here. And in the edit, that improvisational edit that you mentioned, Stephen, it's just trying to grab together all these different ideas and processes that he's given to all the different departments in this, in terms of art direction, sound, score, performance, and bring it all together to more create this film that's about a feeling than it is necessarily about a plot.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree.
So if you'd like to check out more At Eternity's Gate content, do head over to the Curzon blog, where we've got two wonderful new additions there. We've got 10 of our favourite, somewhat lesser-known films about artists. There's a great double bill there of Russian Ark and Francophonia, which are two of the most relaxing cinema experiences that I've ever had. God, they are wonderfully calming. Sam, you and I saw Russian Ark when we were both quite sleepy in Berlin.
Very, very sleepy.
And it was very nice. and there's also a short video essay on there too that looks at the influence that Van Gogh's paintings may have had on film composition. That's covering everything from A Clockwork Orange to Chatham Tango. So make sure you check that out too. It's less than 2 minutes, so you can certainly take the time out of your day to check that one out. I would encourage you to.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now it is time to roll up the curtain, and unlike poor Vincent, we're all ears to talk about Dumbo.
Ooh.
He did it! Ooh.
That's the connection.
Oh my God!
There it is. There it is. It's all about ears.
Wow.
Of course. Wow. Of course it is.
I feel like that was too soon.
I need a moment.
So this is the second big budget Burton blockbuster Disney remake. It's Dumbo. It's a beloved classic. Now it has been made twisted by the mind of Tim Burton. Ella, tell us a little bit about this one.
So based on the original Disney animation, Dumbo tells a story of a small elephant who is born with very large ears. In Tim Burton's version, this is also what happens, but the story kind of expands and it sees Dumbo, who's taken care of by a family at the circus where he's at. The father of his family is Colin Farrell, who has two children. They kind of help Dumbo come to terms with his role within the circus, which is led by ringmaster Danny DeVito, but is threatened by Mr. Vandermeer, played by Michael Keaton.
Wow, and there is a lot of additions to the original film as well, which we will delve into momentarily. But I want to start by just talking about Tim Burton, because at a certain point in our lives, there would have been great excitement about the new Tim Burton film. And imagine getting Tim Burton $200 million to make whatever he wanted. And that would have been a wonderful thing to see out there maybe 20 years ago. How are we feeling about Burton now?
I think you were more excited for the new like Jack Skellington hoodie, weren't you, Sam?
Yeah, when I was about, I'd say age between 10 and...
25.
Yeah. Well, Tim Burton, I think this is the case for a lot of people, I think, that Tim Burton was the first person you realised was a director. And you're like, oh, that's what a director does. You make your film about your personality, and he was the first director who I could... at a young age, it recognized his films without knowing he directed it and learned what a director was. And so he's the first auteur that I kind of attached myself to.
It's all right to say you love him.
I do love him, yeah. and he's had, you know, perhaps the weirdest career in Hollywood, considering how he started making, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice, which are huge box office successes, considering how absolutely insane they are. Mm. And then Batman, which became, you know, one of the highest grossing films of all time. So he's always been doing these big blockbusters, but in his own way. And I think since, you know, the early 2000s, they haven't been as well received, even though they pretty much all make a hell of money.
Yeah, I think since then it's been more a case of blockbusters.
I said a hell of money. That's not a phrase.
I wasn't going to say it. I kind of
like
it.
A thing.
I kind of like
a hell of money.
Oh, hell of money.
Scene one, a hell of money.
The house that Burton built.
They'll make a ton of money.
But I think since the turn of the millennium, those Burton films, those blockbusters, they have more been forced upon him and have been maybe... squeezed into a Burton-shaped box that maybe they didn't organically fit into.
Yeah, I think he used to be like, oh, I could do something with that. And now he's like, yeah, I guess I could do something with that.
All right. And so that definitely leads us into exciting anticipation for Dumbo, for sure. Ella, how does this one compare to that classic, that 62-minute classic?
Now, I must say, that 62-minute classic... he's very, very close to my heart. And I think with all of these Disney remakes that are coming up, I mean, there are so many that there's always one that you think, if they mess that up, I will roll up my sleeves. Dumbo was that for me. One great thing that Tim Burton's Dumbo has kept is a lot of the striking images from the first film. And he's really transposed them in a way that you think can only be done with the visual effects and the resources that he has. So, notably, I was looking out for the scene that gave me nightmares for about 10 to 15 years, which is the pink elephants. And he's got that in this film. And it's just wonderful. And it's interesting because all of the bits in the original film, when there's this thing about did Dumbo get drunk on soap bubbles and all of that kind of thing, they kind of wink to that and you think, oh no, they're just going to leave it there. They're just going to, you know, they're not going to be silly with this and go with that. But then the pink elephants come back in a really different way and you've just got this beautiful, really striking magenta, which just, it really contrasts with the rest of the film, which is all in these tones of greys and just kind of drab asphalt kind of
it's like this moment of bubblegum thrown into a series of unfortunate events aesthetic.
Absolutely. But then the film does what I was worried it would do and what a few Disney live action remakes do, is that when these stories shift from these 1960s animated films where you've got magical talking animals, then when you bring that into 2019, when people are cynical about everything and have seen everything, you've got to put something on screen that people will believe. And you think, well, elephants don't talk. If they have big ears, they've got to be quiet, and there's definitely no crows that sing. So that means that in this film, the focus has shifted over to the humans instead. So Dumbo is this thing who he's looked at, he's laughed at in the same way as the original, but the characters defending him are now humans. And I think that kind of, it dilutes the magic a little bit. And then your humans have got to be so convincing to be worth watching more than the original animals were. And I'm not sure if they are completely.
It's interesting what you say about Burton's leads being these outsiders, like the Edward, your Batmans, a lot of these characters are the central lead performance as well. And it's interesting here that perhaps the film falls away or loses its magic in those moments where the person, or in this case an elephant that maybe Burton is most attached to, is not at center stage.
Yeah.
And it hits its highest points when Dumbo, the name of the film, is at the center of it.
Absolutely.
And where you get these magical circus choreographed moments.
Yeah, like, oh my God, when that elephant flies, it's amazing. I think just, I've always loved the way that Tim Burton builds these worlds, like, visually, and I think the effects are always so impressive. And the music as well, like, the way he always works with his longtime collaborator and composer, Danny Elfman, they just, for me, that they are the masters of modern fairy tales. I think they're so good at making you believe in magic, which made me a bit disappointed that then you shift focus to, you know, these two kids, Colin Farrell's kids, who are perfectly nice and good and they have terrific intentions, but they're not Dumbo. Like, they're not singing crows.
Elephant.
They're not a flying elephant. They're not singing crows.
Yeah.
They're not a talking mouse. And also, they're not given much of a personality. I think they've got a problem that a lot of characters who aren't your, you know, heroic leading man have, in that these two kids, who sound quite good on paper, but their identities and personalities aren't fleshed out. So you've got the girl who is kind of the talking one who's leading. She's the one who talks most and she defends Dumbo and she's the one, you know, making things happen. And her defining characteristic is that she wants to be a scientist. And that's great when she says it the first time, or maybe 10, 12 times. And whenever anyone asks her anything about Dumbo, she's like, oh, well, we'll do it with scientific reasoning and I'm going to create things and do things. And you're like, that's great. But it just seems like a really tokenistic thing, which was like, oh, look, we'll let a girl do lots of talking and we'll let her do things that, you know, usually men do. But then her personality has no more than that. Mm. And you don't really sense any kind of chemistry with Dumbo, with her brother, who doesn't even have like a one line, I will be a scientist or astronaut.
Like a Bobby Draper, but for Dumbo.
Yes.
Dumbo and At Eternity's Gate, they're not the only things available this week in the cinema or on Curzon Home Cinema. We've got a couple of new releases and some older classics put up on the service. So we've got Hirokazu Koreeda's Shoplifters, which has just dropped on there. Stephen, you did an episode a while back on that film.
A lovely film, one of my favourites of last year, possibly my favourite. Saw the Blu-ray in a shop the other day. Almost cried just from the cover. So go, yeah, definitely go see that.
What's going on? And Sam, on the we've also got the
don't start with me again.
Sam, we've also got the Portrait of the Artist collection on Curzon Home Cinema. Any of the Blu-rays on there made you cry?
No. No, they didn't. But I'll tell you what's on this collection, Jake.
So as we mentioned earlier, Loving Vincent is on there. We've also got Frida starring... We've also got Frida starring Salma Hayek. Mr. Turner is on there. Faces Places. The Banksy film Exit Through the Gift Shop. The Draftsman's Contract, which I know you're a big fan of.
I certainly am, yeah.
All tying in well. To...
Got any Andrei Rublev on there?
We do have Andrei Rublev on there.
Nice.
So all these films that you spoke about earlier, this, you know, how films can represent artists, they're all on there tying into At Eternity's Gate, which is also on Curzon Home Cinema this weekend.
If you've got any thoughts on At Eternity's Gate or Dumbo or any more of your favourite artistic portraits, do email us at podcast@curzon.com or you can tweet us at Curzon Cinemas as well. Do get in touch. If it's your first time listening to the show, then please subscribe. You can do that on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, do leave us a review or a comment. That would be absolutely wonderful. And if you have managed to get through all of this and you still want to hear more from us, you can follow us all across various social media. Stephen, you're exclusively a letterboxed man these days.
I am.
You can keep up your diary of what you've been watching.
Yep.
What's your username on there?
Stephen Ryder with two R's at the end.
Lovely. Ella, you're on Twitter?
I am. am indeed. I am at EFE Kemp.
And Sam, you're there as well.
I'm there, just in the background, just watching everyone else.
Yeah, lovely.
That's Sam Howlett underscore one.
And I am there too. They haven't kicked me out just yet. And you can find me at Jake H. Cunningham. Thank you so much for listening. Farewell.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.